In 2 or 3 weeks' time, we are going to deliver the first laser dome, the big system, to the IDF. This is revolutionary. And this is just the beginning. For the first time in human history, we are able to shoot down missiles, rockets, even artillery shells, mortar shells, not with projectiles, not with missiles or artillery shells, but with light.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Mohab Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute and a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute for National Security is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to tracing Israel's security, its regional integration, and its international alliances. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise to bring you fresh insights into what's really happening in Israel and the Middle East.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we read your comments and your suggestions, so please keep them coming. It's great to be back. It's great to be together again. I'm glad that this worked out, that we could film at the same time. And we have a truly fascinating guest this week, Dr. Yuval Steinitz, who is currently chair of Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, perhaps certainly Israel's leading and perhaps one of the world's leading national defense technology company. Dr. Steinitz also served as a minister, as a member of Israel's security cabinet, and has vast experience regarding Israel's strategic challenges and dilemmas.
He also wrote two really good books. For those of you our listeners who read Hebrew books, he has like a very fun conversational way of writing. And he talked about, one is about the natural gas in Israel and the sort of politics of you know, allowing Israel to finally develop its gas fields and to make a lot of money off of that. And then the other one is like his sort of political memoir. Really enjoyed both of them.
And fascinating, he actually started on the hard left of the Israeli political spectrum. In fact, I believe was even injured in a protest that Peace Now, or one of the left-wing groups, then moved to the right, became a minister with the Likud, was a philosopher, an academic, then a politician, then the head of a defense company. Fascinating journey. We really get into a lot of those, really unpack that in the conversation with him. But obviously, our region, as always, is never a dull moment. Gaza, the north, Iran. Lav, where do you think we should start?
Let's start with Gaza.
Always a good place to start.
What's happening on the yellow line?
So every day we're hearing different reports about incidents that are happening on the yellow line. And I think it's very important for our listeners and our viewers to understand the reality. Gaza's, what you have essentially is this yellow line, which is a largely imaginary line, which is now being demarcated in some places by yellow spray-painted cinder blocks, essentially, which is between 1 to 2.5, at least in the vis-a-vis facing the major populated parts of Gaza, Gaza City, the camps in the south. It is about 1 to 2.5 miles from the Israeli border. So you have the Israeli border, then about a mile away, or say 1 to 2 miles away, you have this yellow line, and then you have Gaza City and Khan Yunis and other major parts of the Gaza Strip. It's a little bit different in the north and the south, but that is the center and the north center part of Gaza. And it's just important for people to realize, I think, the distances. You know, you could drive in a, let's say, in a white Toyota pickup truck from the yellow line to Israel, I don't know, 10 minutes, maybe probably less. And in the various discussions that are happening, both in terms of Israel's determined effort to prevent potential terrorists or terrorists from crossing the yellow line, and also in the context of the idea that Israel should withdraw further, you know, to very various instances adjacent to the border, and then international troops would come in, international stabilization force, and somehow they would prevent IDF Hamas from once again infiltrating that. We have to realize that the room for error here is almost non-existent, and the danger of having Hamas once again reestablish itself in areas that would essentially be 5 minutes away from the nearest Israeli community, the nearest Israeli kibbutz, is very significant. And the last thing I'll add is that, you know, there have been various media reports, for example, of Hamas looking for the body of a murdered hostage in the Zaytun neighborhood within the yellow line. So again, Hamas is looking for a terror tunnel where it hid the body of the terrorist, which has not been discovered, and Israel hasn't discovered it, and Hamas knows it's there. Right now, their interest is to return the bodies. But what that means is that a mile away from the border with Israel, there are terror tunnels that have not been discovered. The Hamas knows where they are, and that, in theory, they could pop out of tomorrow and carry out the next kidnapping attack. So the atmosphere and the situation is quite fragile.
Yeah, and we should remind our listeners that at this point, there are still two hostages' bodies left in Gaza. Frankly, we've gotten back more hostages' bodies than I ever thought we would. But it sort of makes me think, like, just Hamas must know where every single one is if we're already down to two. And it feels like they're trying to draw out time as much as possible before it gets to the point where Israel and the U.S. sort of run out of patience and say, okay, phase one of the ceasefire is over. Now we're going to take greater action to eradicate Hamas. And we've talked about this at length in past episodes, that different international forces that are willing to come into Gaza and serve as peacekeeping forces are not willing to fight Hamas. And we were saying this before their governments were saying it publicly, but you've heard the King of Jordan said it, and the president of Indonesia, I believe it was the president, someone high up in Indonesia said it. I feel like we are getting to a point there where a decision has to be made, whether we want this to be the new Gaza, where there's the yellow line and Israel controls half of Gaza and Hamas controls the other half, or if something's going to actually happen so that Hamas doesn't serve in any sort of governing, controlling capacity and is actually disarmed and demilitarized.
And again, that's the situation now, is that it's not a question of whether Hamas is present and armed 1-2 miles from the Israeli border. It's absolutely out in the open. And there's, because of the ceasefire, they are openly reasserting their control and taking over control of that entire Western Gaza territory that they control. So there is this border with Israel. There is, you know, 1 or 2 miles, an imaginary line. And then there is openly armed Hamas terrorists operating on the other side of that yellow line. We're also, beyond Gaza, we are marking this month 1 year to the ceasefire in Lebanon. But that border, too, has been not quiet over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of Hezbollah activity near the border, and Israel has been striking at them to make sure that they can't shoot missiles and also can't stockpile missiles near the border with Israel. And Israel killed essentially the head of Hezbollah's military. His name is Tabatabai. But the ceasefire had been shaky for a long time before that. And the U.S. envoy to Lebanon, Tom Barrack, said to the Lebanese army, basically, like, you need to get your act together and you need to do more to remove Hezbollah from southern Lebanon, because that's what you committed to in this ceasefire and you're not doing it. So it's not just Israel, you know, and Israel is taking all of this action, and the U.S. has been fine with it. And, you know, there's some countries in the world who haven't been fine with it, but it's not getting a lot of international attention, which is the way it's better that way. But I find the situation to be very similar to Gaza in the sense that, you know, there's strategic patience. Israel has waited for a year with this ceasefire to see if it'll stick, to see if the Lebanese army will act. And then there's going back to what Israelis have called the conceptia, the sort of preconception where you just take things for granted that they have to be this way, even though it's a poor security situation for our country. And I'm not sure where you draw that line, where, okay, we can still wait and we can still be patient and try to hope that this works out the way it is on paper. But I feel like with Lebanon, it seems like Israel's losing patience. And with Gaza, as I said before, I do feel like we're going to reach like a decision point fairly soon.
In Lebanon, I think it's Hezbollah that's facing a really difficult dilemma decision point right now. Its chief of staff was eliminated by Israel in Beirut. On the one hand, it knows that if it doesn't react, it looks weak. And it gives also perhaps an opening or an excuse to the Lebanese government to take more aggressive action to disarm it or to remove it. And then if it does react, it risks, you know, Israel has the vast superiority currently, and it risks suffering very great significant blows. And it also risks this whole effort that it's making to rebuild its arms, to rebuild its units, to recruit and train new fighters. So it's facing a really difficult dilemma. And I don't think we've seen the last word either. It obviously, Iran is in a very different place also in terms of the support that it could provide to Hezbollah. We've seen the rial dropping almost to record lows. The Iranians now are beginning a renomination, a redenomination. They're essentially cutting four zeros off of the rial because of inflation. It's been going up and up. They're hoping that that'll happen. Iran is facing perhaps the worst water crisis in its history, which is, it's ironic, but given that Israel is the world's leader in water recycling and water reuse, if there was a potential for cooperation between Israel and Iran, Israel could be extremely beneficial to Iran with that challenge, but obviously under the current Ayatollah regime, that's not possible. So given the fact that Iran is not really in a position right now to really support Hezbollah or Hamas, both of these terrorist groups and certainly Hezbollah are facing a really strong dilemma how to react, if at all, to Israel's recent strikes.
So I want to just mention one story, a domestic story in Israel, which is it's a very big deal. But we won't know exactly why or how for some time. The story is that Prime Minister Netanyahu has asked President Herzog to pardon him. As I'm sure our listeners know, Netanyahu was indicted 6 years ago on fraud, breach of trust, and bribery. Although bribery, the judges told the defense like a year and a half ago already that they don't actually have any proof, good proof of that, so they should drop that charge. But fraud and breach of trust, let's say. And he has a trial that's been ongoing for years now. And more recently, the judges have said that he needs to be in court 3 days a week. So Netanyahu finds himself constantly writing letters to the judges saying, please, can we postpone my court date? Please, can we postpone my court date? President Trump is also really sick of Netanyahu being in the courtroom and not being available for whatever cooperation between the U.S. and Israel. And he also asked President Herzog to pardon Netanyahu. I mean, there's obviously something political there as well, where Trump sees Netanyahu as an ally, and I think Trump probably relates to Netanyahu's legal predicaments. But on paper, the reason is that they have so much to do together, and Netanyahu has no time to do it. And Netanyahu said this himself also in a video that he released right after asking Herzog for the pardon. So this kind of pardon would be unprecedented. The vast majority of pardons issued by Israeli presidents are after a conviction for a crime. The one time that it was different was in what was called the Bus 300 affair. Essentially, there was a terrorist attack on a bus. The Shabak captured some of the terrorists alive. And even though they were alive and tied up, the Shabak killed them. And that's not allowed. And so that there wasn't an issue where like intelligence and like operations important information was revealed in court, the president pardoned the Shabak agents before they were even indicted. But that's different from Netanyahu, who has been indicted as in the middle of a trial. So there's really no precedent for this. And President Herzog's office has said that they are looking into it. They're talking to the justice minister. They're talking to their own legal advisor. And so a decision probably won't be forthcoming for a few weeks. But this is probably going to be what a lot of Israelis are talking about in the coming days.
And we'll have to see how this question of the potential pardon for Netanyahu and more general, a lot of the questions about whether Israel does resume hostilities, doesn't resume hostilities. I think we can't ignore the fact that the fact that we're heading into an election year does have an impact. There's been an argument I've heard by some people online or some media commentators saying, before the ceasefire, isn't the war only ongoing because of Netanyahu's political considerations or desire to remain in power? And I think that's a misunderstanding of Israeli politics. I think that Netanyahu would like to get to elections when it's clear that Hezbollah has been deterred, that Hamas is in the process of being removed from power in Gaza, where Israelis are not, the vast majority of Israelis are not on the front lines, not on the reserves, where we've seen over the last few weeks more capital, announcements of investments coming to Israel, some positive changes in legislation. Hopefully that will make it easier to invest in Israel. It's not true that it's necessarily better for Netanyahu when elections come that the country be in the midst of a conflict. It may well be the opposite, that a return to calm and to some sort of normalcy, at the same time not seeing Hamas, you know, essentially retake the Gaza Strip, would be the best situation for the reigning prime minister. We'll have to see. And we'll obviously keep tracking these developments closely over the coming months. Our guest this week is Dr. Yuval Steinitz. Dr. Steinitz began his career as an academic with a PhD in philosophy. He wrote two best-selling books in philosophy, one called An Invitation to Philosophy, and the second entitled A Logical Scientific Missile to God and Back. He was a lecturer at Haifa University. He was also a left-wing activist with the Peace Now movement. Following the Oslo Accords, he changed his political views, moved to the right, joined the Likud, and entered the Knesset for the first time in 1999. He then spent 22 years as an elected official in Israel, serving as chair of the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, as Israel's finance minister, where he led Israel into the OECD. He served as Minister of Intelligence and Strategic Affairs, where I had the privilege of working with him as a member of that ministry's professional staff, and then as Israel's Ministry of Energy, where he's widely credited with being one who got Israel's natural gas reserves out of the ground. And that's been a key part of Israel's economy, energy independence, and exports since that time. In 2023, Dr. Steinitz was appointed head of Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, Israel's leading, in fact, probably one of the world's leading defense technology companies, the company that is responsible, that developed the Iron Dome, the Iron Beam laser system that is being used to shoot down already today rockets and missiles threatening Israel, the Spike missiles, many other leading defense technology systems, and it's really on the cutting edge of what tomorrow's battlefield is going to look like. And we go really in depth in this conversation, both into the challenges facing Israel today and where defense technology is going to take us tomorrow, including in terms of the U.S.-Israel relationship. So please stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Yuval Steinitz. Dr. Yuval Steinitz, it's such a pleasure to have you join us on the Miskav Mideast Horizons podcast. Thank you so much for coming. As we face a Middle East that's very fluid, very dynamic, with a possibility of renewed fighting, perhaps in the north, perhaps in Gaza, perhaps with Iran, as chairman of Rafael, you are very much in the heart, the beating heart of Israel's defense ecosystem. What role has Rafael and advanced technologies played in this multi-front war that Israel's been engaged in for the last 2+ years? And what do you see as the next technological leaps that will reshape the battlefield as we know it?
Well, the role is dominant role, both in the ongoing war in Gaza and Lebanon, but also more so with a 12 days conflict between Israel and Iran. Without technology, we couldn't have done most of the things. Let's start maybe on defense, on sheer defense. In the last 2 years, close to 40,000 rockets and missiles were fired toward Israel from all over the Middle East, mostly from Gaza and Lebanon, but also from Syria, from Iraq, from Iran, and even from Yemen. Iron Dome, which is the only system of its kind in the world, Iron Dome did about 90-95% of the defense work. Without Iron Dome, we would have a bloodshed in our major cities, in Tel Aviv, in the Dan Block, in Jerusalem, in Haifa, Ashdod, Netanya, Be'er Sheva, all over the country. Without Iron Dome, the country couldn't function. People would not go to work. Industries, high-tech, universities, hospitals, everything would be paralyzed. Pupils would not go to school. Everybody would stay at home, close to the shelter or to the protected area, Merchav Mugan, with his family and kids. Only emergencies would function. Even the IDF would find it difficult to function without the Iron Dome defense on its air bases, mobilization center, supply bases, and so on and so forth. So even if we will focus now just on missile defense, on Iron Dome, together with, of course, with David Sling and the Arrow, but it was mainly, most of the burden was on Iron Dome, it would be completely different without Iron Dome, without this technological development, breakthrough, one can say, without our capacity to shoot down incoming missiles and rockets with a success rate which is not 100%, but not far away from 100%, somewhere between 95 and 100%. Without it, it would be completely different. And the country would be in completely different situation, not just several thousand additional casualties, but the economy and the country would look today totally different. So this is just one example to show, to emphasize how crucial is technology in general, and the technology of Rafael, Iron Dome and David Sling were developed and manufactured by Rafael defense systems. How is Rafael sometimes is really crucial to the survivability and well-being of the state of Israel.
You know, I heard that you called the 12-day war with Iran the first Rafael war. Why did you say that?
That's a little bit humoristic also, but no doubt it is the most technological conflict ever in human history. Because think about it, all the war between Israel and Iran, it was a real war that took 12 days, but everything was long distance war. Yeah, the everything was between the ranges. Yeah, we fired on each other, exchange fire from ranges starting from 1,000 kilometers, that is the minimum, to up to 2,500 kilometers. That was the longest distance that we attack. So there was no engagement of any ground forces here, no direct engagement. Still, it was a full-scale war. It was executed mainly by the Israeli Air Force, 90% or 95%, which did excellent work. Of course, intelligence was also very important, because without accurate and detailed intelligence, you couldn't strike all the facilities and all the right commanders of the Iranian army and scientists and so on and so forth. But this is not enough. Without the third part is of course the scientific technological edge of Israel, which play actually a prominent role here. Just think about the initial surprise attack. Yeah? In the first 10 or 20 seconds, we destroyed all the top security leader of Iran. We killed the chief of staff and the deputy chief of staff and the commander of the Air Force and the commander of the ballistic missile division and the commander of air defense and commander of the intelligence. And we did this both with the Revolutionary Guard and with the regular army. And we killed the top 13 or 14 scientists that were working directly on developing the nuclear weapon. All this happened in the first few seconds of the war. Why this is amazing? Because the first thing you think about it is that somebody has provided us very good intelligence to know exactly at that night, it was 2.5 hours after midnight, almost 3 o'clock in the morning, to know exactly where everybody is staying. Some were sleeping in their homes, some were sleeping in hotels, and some were staying in their headquarters, sometimes in underground headquarters. Okay, so clearly it's amazing that to know everybody where everybody are. But the more amazing factor was that according to the media, yeah, according to Wikipedia, 200 Israeli aircrafts were flying 2.5 hours to where they ran, crossing at least two countries in their way, either Jordan or Syria, and then Iraq, or Kuwait, or the Gulf, then reaching Iran, then have to travel another significant distance to cities like Tehran and Isfahan, and the Iranian saw nothing. They were ready. They were on the alert. Yeah, they thought that something might happen. They took it into account. They increased their readiness, but they saw nothing. Then those 200 aircrafts have to release different kind of bombs, missiles, munition. Again, hundreds of bombs and different kinds of munition from different distances are traveling to their targets, and the Iranian see nothing. They realize that they are under attack only when they heard the first blasts. This is technological superiority. It's not the airplanes themselves, because most of them were not F-35, were not stealths. It's something happened here that enabled us to make this surprise attack with hundreds of airplanes, with many hundreds of munition, and without the Iranian noticing and warning themselves that something is taking place. So this is mainly technology. It's not the way that you fly the airplane, because it's the same F-15 or F-16. It's something else. Then in the next day and a half, we managed to achieve significant air superiority over Iran, including the capital Tehran. Again, just think about it. The Russians are trying to gain air superiority over Kiev for more than 3 years now. And Kiev is just 120 kilometers from the border with Belarus, which is part of the Russian military garrison. Russia is a global superpower with thousands of aircraft. And for 3 years, they didn't gain air superiority over Kiev. They can fly over Kiev, but they might also shoot down. They don't do it very often. We achieved air superiority over Tehran, which is 1,500 kilometers from Israel, in a day and a half.
It's remarkable, truly.
This is mainly due to technology, not to anything else, but it's mainly due to technology.
First of all, I mean, incredible. What comes next? How is technology that Rafael is developing, that other players in the Israeli ecosystem are developing, how is that going to change the battlefield in the coming years, in the coming decade?
Look, the most significant development that we can speak about it, because I'm unable to elaborate on many things, but is the laser revolution. It's true that we already implemented laser devices, two laser devices during the war with Hezbollah, and we shoot down roughly 50 drones, 50 UAVs coming from Lebanon with laser, with little laser systems, not the big one. And in 2 or 3 weeks' time, we are going to deliver the first laser dome, the big system, to the IDF. This is revolutionary. And this is just the beginning. For the first time in human history, we are able to shoot down missiles, rockets, even artillery shells, mortar shells, not with projectiles, not with missiles or artillery shells, but with light. Laser is actually a light beam. It's a very energetic and concentrate kind of light. And we in Rafael after 60 years that all the superpowers, including the United States, but also China and Britain and Germany and Russia, all of them were trying to develop effective laser weapon. We managed to do it, and we already intercepted in tests many dozens, maybe even hundreds of rockets and artillery shells and UAVs and drones and all the bad things. This is revolutionary, and I am confident that this is just the beginning. Nowadays, it will enable us to shoot down rockets and missiles from Lebanon and Gaza, from short range or medium range, not from Iran at the beginning. It's already revolutionary. Why? Because you are doing three things. First, it will enable us to come very close to 100% interception success rate. Together, it will be combined with Iron Dome and David Sling. Second, and not less important, it will change all the economy of this war. Because today, if it costs Hezbollah or Hamas between $5,000 to $10,000 to develop short or medium range rockets and to launch it toward Israel, and we will intercept it with Iron Dome interceptors, the Iron Dome interceptors will cost roughly, let's say, around $50,000 each. So we are paying more to intercept the incoming missiles than it costs them to reproduce, to produce more. Okay, it's not exactly, because we have to shoot down only one out of three or four, because we are very selective. If something is going to the open field or to the sea, we won't intercept it. So, but still, it's more expensive to intercept than to attack. To defend is more expensive than to attack. With Laser Dome, it's totally upside down. It's totally changed. Why? Because for them, it still costs, let's say, $10,000 to produce and launch a medium rocket, a medium range rocket from Lebanon. And for us, it will cost $2 or $3 to intercept it, because all you need is to recharge the Laser Dome battery, either from the electricity system, from the grid, or with a generator. But the cost will be totally different. Another advantage is that we will be able to save most of the alarms in Israel. Why? Because let's assume today they shoot missile from Gaza to where Tel Aviv, okay? Since Iron Dome is not 100% success rate, but 98 or 99, or close to 100%, still, one of 100 or two of 100 missiles will ending landing in Tel Aviv. So we will put the alarm in Tel Aviv, because we don't want, even once in a while, that people will go in the street and suddenly a rocket will explode on them. So we prefer that people will take some shelter until it is over. But with the laser, once the laser is rising above Gaza, interception will start immediately, because the laser will reach the missile, the incoming missile rocket, with the speed of light. With Iron Dome, it's two missiles that are flying now, one from Gaza and one from the Tel Aviv region, to meet each other midway. It will take them 1 minute to meet each other. And then we shall see if interception was successful or not. From Gaza, it will take 2 or 3 seconds. Once a missile is above Gaza, it will be intercepted immediately. We can wait. We won't put the alarm on in Tel Aviv, because we shall see immediately that if we succeed to intercept or not, and if we fail to intercept, we will have another opportunity, and then we shall put the alarm. So it will cost us much less. We will be able not to disturb the citizens, the people of Israel, so often. All the advantages. I assume that in a few years' time, we will be able to upgrade the laser, so we will be able also to intercept long-range ballistic missiles from Iran or Yemen, but this will take some extra time.
So I want to go back to what you said about the economic benefits of the system, because it made me think about military aid from the United States. And I wonder if you think that this is going to have an impact on the future of military aid from the U.S., because we're not going to have to request those interceptors anymore, which is something that Israel has to do annually, aside from the regular MOU. And also just more broadly, the U.S.-Israel relationship is very strong at the presidential level, but seems to be at a bit of a crossroads at other levels of government. And I wanted to know, as someone who's really seen it up close over many years at this point, where you see things going.
First, as I mentioned before, at least in the next few years, a laser dome will not replace Iron Dome, but will be integrated or combined with Iron Dome together. In many cases, we will be able to use the laser interceptors, but there might be also cases, even many cases, in which we will prefer to use a regular Iron Dome interceptors. Because of many things, weather conditions, very large barrages, or other things, okay? So at least for the time being, for the next 3 or 4 years, we will have the laser, but we will still preserve the more traditional interceptors for our missile defense. In the future, it might change. I mean, this depends about our success of developing, of upgrading and developing new generation of the laser system, so we will be able to use more and more laser and less other things. By the way, just think about it. I want just to make another comment. It's why it's so revolutionary. Since the dawn of history, since the prehistoric period, unfortunately, people were fighting each other. The main, how did we fight each other? By throwing projectiles, throwing objects on each other. First, they were throwing stones or blocks on each other in the prehistoric period. Then people develop arrows, yeah, and were shooting arrows on each other. Then balistras in the Roman Empire. The gun were invented and people were shooting shells, and sometimes they fulfill the shell with explosives. But still, one side is shooting, launching, throwing projectiles to where the other side. Today it's mostly missiles that are being used in order to hit, to intercept, to harm the other side, missiles and rockets. But it's always projectiles that are moving through the air toward the other side. Here, it's totally different. We don't use any material object, any projectile. We only light the target and we destroyed it with light. So the speed is not few hundred kilometers per hour or few thousand kilometers per hour. It's 300,000 kilometers per second. It's like the rest of the world is standing still and the laser is being used. So it's more revolutionary than it looked from the outset. Now about Israel-US relations. I think the relations are very tight and good. And the commitment, United States cannot have, of course, we badly need the support of the United States, but the United States cannot have a better and more efficient partner, ally in the Middle East than Israel. So I think it's mutually beneficial to such extent for both sides that even if there will be ups and downs, and sometimes there is some criticism and some bitterness, both sides should be irresponsible and stupid enough in order to cancel it. So I believe that the U.S.-Israel alliance is strong and will remain strong to any foreseeable future, despite the strange noises that we hear here and there.
Could you go a little bit deeper into that point, because it's obviously a point that's being debated, social media, in the halls of power in some places. What are benefits that, from your experience, because Rafael also works with the U.S. defense industry, that the U.S. accrues from its cooperation with Rafael, with Israel, with the IDF more generally? And what are ways that that cooperation can be expanded or deepened? And just as a side question, are there any other countries besides Israel that have developed this kind of laser dome to date?
No, here and there you hear something that the Brits have done or the Chinese, but it's not the same. They don't have the unique Rafael adaptive optics. And what they are speaking about it is shooting drones, or even not drones, little UAVs, little drones, from distances of 100 meters or 200 meters, maximum 300 meters. And we are speaking about intercepting not drones and not slow UAVs, but intercepting missiles and rockets and even artillery shells in the air from kilometers away, many kilometers away. It's totally different. Just to explain it, the problem with laser weapon, it was clear from the outset, 60 years ago when the laser was discovered in the United States, it became immediately clear that this is a very energetic beam of light, and accurate and precise and condensed, so you can have laser printers. And you can make operations, IE operations or other operations with laser. Or you can even cut steel or other materials with laser if you want to be very accurate. But all this has been done from distances of few centimeters. When you are going to the doctor, to the clinic to make IE surgery with laser, the laser source is 5 or 10 centimeters from your eye. Why this is relevant? Because once you increase the distance, the laser beam interferes with the air, especially is influenced by different or differences of temperature, even if they are very minor. So after 10 meters, you feel still that it's very concrete and very precise. After 100 meters from a little laser beam, you will get something like this. It will spread. After 1 kilometer, it will be already like this. Yeah, it will be totally ineffective. And for 60 years, nobody found a way how to overcome the atmospheric interference with the laser. Until three PhDs in physics in Rafael, 5 years ago, they invented the Rafael adaptive optic. You need kind of adaptive optic that enable us, it's like to ignore the air interference, to bypass all the problem of the air interference and to get into the target when we are still extremely energetic and precise. And therefore, for the first time, we are able to shoot down missiles and rockets in very, very large distance. But no other country is even close to this patent or this technology. Now you ask about the advantages. So first I can say, and I'm very satisfied as Rafael chairman, the United States Army, I mean Army, including Air Force, Marines, Navy, all the branches, are using many things that are produced or developed by Rafael. For example, if you take lightning pods is the pods that you put on an aircraft like F-16, F-15, F-18, you hang it on the aircraft, almost like a bomb or like a fuel tank, and it's enable the aircraft to gather intelligence and also to attack targets from 100 or 150 kilometers ahead. So if you want to attack, not to fly over the target, but to investigate the target and even to attack it from far away, from 100 kilometers away or more, you need the lightning pod. Okay, so we are in the United States. We produce our lightning pods together with Northrop Grumman. In Europe, we sell them directly. In United States, we produce it in Israel, but also together in United States with Northrop Grumman. Most of the lightning pods of American aircrafts are Rafael lightning pods. Rafael lightning pods that are produced and sold also by Northrop Grumman. Just one little example. Today, the United States has decided, already bought hundreds, and I think it's going to be many thousands of Spike Enlos missiles to Apache helicopters. Although United States have the Hellfire, which is very good missiles, but the Hellfire is good for 8 kilometers, and the Spike Enlos can hit targets beyond 50 kilometers away. So it's tactical missile, but with range of 50 kilometers and above, and complete accuracy. So there are already many systems there. We sold also Iron Dome batteries to the U.S. Marines. By the way, last week, exactly a week ago, I was in Arkansas, in Camden, and we inaugurate a new factory, a new facility called R2S, which is we established together with Raytheon to produce Iron Dome interceptors in the United States. And we were there together with Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders to inaugurate the facility in Camden, Arkansas. And in 2 months' time, we will be producing the first Iron Dome interceptors on U.S. soil, both for Israel needs to increase our, but also to the Marines needs. And I hope in the future, also to other branches in the United States. You know, take all the issue of missile defense, intercepting missiles at all. I think that the fact that United States combined with Israel did help the United States also to achieve significant progress with its missile defense systems. So it's a very close and tight collaboration. And also with the laser, we already were approached by some American companies that want to work with us or to participate with us. So on many issues, I cannot elaborate all of them, but on many issues, it's true. It's an alliance between the giant and the dwarf. And we are not confused. We know who is the dwarf here. In the story, it's Israel, and who is the giant? It's the United States. But sometimes the dwarf can also contribute to the giant, in my view, it's very, very important. By the way, we are going to open another, even bigger facility in the United States, in Indiana, to produce solid rocket motors in United States, both for our need and also that will be integrated, very advanced solid rocket motors that will be integrated also in U.S. Missiles, in American missiles. This is already under construction now.
So I want to ask you a different kind of question. I read your most recent book called The Political Comedy. I believe it's only available in Hebrew. And I felt one of the running themes of your book was that your background in philosophy, your PhD in philosophy, enabled you to look at things very differently than the like high brass of the defense system and the politicians that were around you. And so I wanted to know how you think that background is helping you now as chairman of Rafael. What are you seeing maybe in a different light than other people?
If I could just add before you answer, if I could just tell us a short story to that effect. When you were Minister of Intelligence and I was part of the professional staff of the ministry, I remember I think it was in 2014, the operation in Gaza, and the IDF's approach was to take a limited operation. And somebody, I don't remember who, we were in a discussion in the office, somebody suggested that Israel consider capturing all of Gaza in order to eliminate Hamas. And right away, all of the senior former intelligence officials, Mossad, Shabak, said, no, that's impossible, that's too hard, and you don't understand, and it's too complicated. And, you know, we shouldn't even think about it. We shouldn't even discuss it. And I remember very clearly you banging on the table and saying, look, we can decide if it's the right move or the wrong move, but if we can't even imagine the possibility, then we shouldn't even be here. We're not going to survive in the Middle East. And we have to be open to all kinds of possibilities and options, even if the brass, you know, the old elite or the guards don't think that it's something we should even consider. So that moment has stayed in my mind, your ability to sort of think outside the box.
So first, thank you, Asher, thank you for working with me, them. Love, thank you for reading my book. But I will tell you like this, I always thought that philosophy is an unconventional weapon, so to say, you know, that it gives you the capacity, the ability to think out of the box, to question everything, not to accept things only because they are because it's the common wisdom, and I think this did help me both when I dealt with national security, but also in economy and in other fields. It's always good to have a philosophical background, and you know, as I said many times in the book, with a philosophical background, you could avoid some of the mistakes and the difficulties that we run into, because one of the major things in philosophy is the not just the need to think logically, but also the need to doubt. All the time to doubt, to re-examine, yeah? Not to take things as for granted. And this is part of the philosophical education, which I think helped me a lot. By the way, the story that Asher is, there is a chapter in my book about this debate in 2014, whether to capture Gaza in its entirety and to defeat the Hamas once and for all, or only to exchange fire, yeah, and to resume our deterrence capacity. And I said from the first day, that it's time for a general campaign in Gaza. First, because they are launching missiles all over the country already. And Ben-Gurion Airport was closed for a few days. And I said, if somebody is launching missiles at Tel Aviv, at Jerusalem, it's not just border incidents. This is a war. And also other enemies in the Middle East must know that if suddenly they launch missiles at Tel Aviv, or at Haifa, or Jerusalem, this is a war. This is not just now invitation to some exchange. They are taking enormous risk. Secondly, and even more important, I said in this debate that what the Hamas are doing in Gaza, they are actually building a military force, an army. It's a primitive army. It's not an army like the IDF or like the US army, but it's an army. They have troops. They have divisions. They have the capacity of attacking into Israel. They have many thousands of rockets. They have artillery. And it's just the beginning. By the way, in 2014, there were only 8,000 Hamas fighters, not 40,000. They were not so well equipped. And I said, either this is against Israel doctrine of defense since Ben-Gurion. Israel doctrine of defense since Ben-Gurion was that we don't have to control all the country west to the Jordan, but we should prevent anybody from deploying significant forces in the West Bank or Gaza, in the state, in the country of Israel. They are building significant force. And if we don't stop it now, I said in 2014, we will have to stop it in the future, and it will be more costly as far as we wait. So my view was that they're shooting on the country. It's a war. It's not an exchange of fire, and it's not what we need is not to resume our deterrence capacity by destroying some buildings. It's a war. We have to destroy our enemies. We have to eradicate the Hamas regime, to destroy their infrastructure, and then maybe they will try to reestablish it. So we will have to deal with it again, but we cannot simply ignore it. But I left alone. All the defense establishment, starting from Bogi Yaalon as defense minister, Gantz as a chief of staff of the IDF, of the chief of staff. Eisenkot, everybody were totally against it, saying that this is, will be a disaster, that we will lose 500 soldiers. Remember, the Hamas was not that strong then, 10 years ago. That instead of Hamas, we will end up with many terrorist groups in each neighbor, and it will be more difficult because there will be no responsible body that we can play the deterrence game with it. Because once they will shoot us from Rafah, we will shoot on Rafah, they will shoot from Gaza, we will deter Gaza, they will shoot from Khan Yunis, or other group will be shoot. So actually what they were saying, that it's better to have one terrorist army like Hamas that controls the area than chaos. And thirdly, they said that we will lose peace agreements, that Egypt and Jordan will cancel the peace agreements with Israel. So we will lose many soldiers, we will gain nothing, and we will lose the peace agreements that we already achieved. No surprise that they convinced almost the entire cabinet. And at the end of this very long evening in 2014, I was the only one who still insist that we have to capture Gaza and to dismantle the Hamas infrastructure.
It's, you know, to thinking about the arc of your career from an academic and a philosopher and a left-wing political activist to a Likud minister in charge of a finance minister leading the natural gas revolution in Israel, the intelligence minister, and now being chair of Israel's leading national defense and technology company. You just to wrap up, what's next? Is there a next?
Well, I don't know. You know, actually, when I left politics, after 24 years in the government, in different cabinets and in the parliament, my initial intention was to go back to academia and to teach philosophy, which I enjoy very much. And then came the proposal from the prime minister himself. So if you refuse to stay in the cabinet in any position whatsoever, because I said 24 years enough is enough. I did a lot. I suffered a lot. Yeah, my family already pushed me to put an end to their suffering. It's difficult. It's not easy to be a politician in Israel. I wanted to go back to the philosophy department. And then came the proposal to become chairman of Rafael, which I couldn't refuse because I always admired Rafael. I think Rafael is a unique defense company. There is nothing similar even in the world. It's the scientific technological advantage of Rafael over any other defense industry in the world is crystal clear. It was crystal clear to me even before I became the chairman. And all the more so other, it's fascinating. It's I called it a Zionist nature reserve. The people are the scientists, the engineers. Most of them are extremely gifted. Many of them are genius. And I really enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation. And we can't wait to see what happens next and what comes next. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All the best.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on social media. You can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com, and we'll be back next week.